You're not there to make friends. You know, some journalists go in and they end up friends for life, you know, with Nicole Kidman, and I'm really not interested in it.
Welcome to In Writing with Hattie Crissell, and that was the voice of the journalist Andrew Billen. I didn't really know Andrew before I went to visit him in Oxford to record this episode, but in recent years his pieces have become essential reading for me. He's been a journalist for 40 years and I think he's one of the best interviewers and feature writers working in the British press. He spent several years at The Observer and in the late 90s went to the Evening Standard and started doing what was known as the Andrew Billen interview every week. But he's now been at The Times since 2002. His subjects over the years have included Tony Blair, David Cameron and the Dalai Lama, and more glittery names like Liza Minnelli and Carrie Fisher. He's got a light touch as a writer and in person too. He's funny and, as far as I can tell, doesn't have much of an ego. Some interviewers write profiles that are really all about themselves. Instead, Andrew uses his knack for forming a rapport to draw out the most unsympathetic of subjects and show them in a new light. I was dying to know how he does it, and we had a good chat in the attic study he shares with his wife. So, over to Andrew. So here we are in your study. So will you describe this room for me?
Well, it's an attic room in a residential street in Oxford. One wall, it's a cartoon of me drawn by Riddell when I left The Observer in 1997. It's a picture of my lovely wife. Lots of commendations, sadly not for my journalism, but for her work as a press officer with the police. And then on the other, behind me, actually on my right when I write, is it's a huge tube poster of me and the Andrew Billen interview, which was, I suppose, my period of minor fame when I did a weekly interview in the Evening Standard. What did it say? I thought I'd fall in love, get married, and then real life set in. And then there's a picture of Ulrika Johnson at her most scrumptious, leaning forward provocatively. And that was quite a
and then there's
a pleasant interview
of you
to do.
Leaning forward provocatively.
Me with my sort of chin resting on in my hands, looking sincere.
So that was a poster on the tube.
Yeah, that was a campaign the Evening Standard ran in the late 90s.
And the tagline is, if you don't get it, you never will.
Yeah.
That's very good.
Quite a nice kind. Anyway, the photographer, Dylan, said, whose name is also on it, on this, it's like a reproduction of the first page of the interview with a huge picture by him of Eureka. And Dylan said to me, look, this is never going to happen again. Our names are going to be on the underground. I'll get a copy of this, and I know someone who can print it up. So wherever I've lived since, this huge picture of Ulrika's breast has really followed me.
I mean, it's not just her breast.
Not just her breast, but it's got a lot of people remark on. And there's no television here, and then there's my absolutely useless PC, which has broken down after 12 years. Sterling service, and the Times has promised to get me a new one, but not for another 3 weeks. I'm at a bit of a loss right now how to do anything, and it's incredibly untidy, full of books, reference books, bits of paper, because I'm still using bits of paper, and generally the apparatus of my trade, which is tape recorders and voice recorders and telephones and mice and computer screens. I was actually told by a self-help writer. It was the only bit of advice I took was do not work directly on a laptop, get another screen, because it will absolutely do your neck in.
Yes.
Over the years.
Very true. And you drew my attention to the fact that you've got, I think you called it an essay plan on the wall.
Yes, I'm absolutely in awe of feature writers who are writing pieces of longer than 1,000 words, who can go into the office and just write the piece, knowing exactly what they want to write. It's all in their head. Simon Hoggart, who was a great writer on The Guardian, used to come into The Observer when I worked there about 12 o'clock, sit down. It was like automatic writing. By 1 o'clock, the piece would be finished, completely faultless, off you'd go for a boozy lunch. But with my intellect, I need to plan, you know, really quite exactly any piece I write. So the process, if it is of interest, is that I get a transcription of the interview I've done. I go through it and take a note of what was said on each page, and I put that up on the window, or glue it to the window. And then next, on the other side of my PC, I have the essay plan that will refer sometimes with numbers to the page numbers on the transcript of the points that will, or the quotes that will illustrate the points I'm making. Because I think every piece should have an argument, you know, an end that talks back to the beginning, and actually just covers the main points.
Yeah. Do you ever struggle, because I do, do you ever struggle with how to finish a piece?
Funnily enough, the finishing I've always found quite easy, and the intros I struggle with.
Oh, really?
And I still don't think they're often brilliant. But by the end, I've really got into it, and I'd like to make the outro, as it were, talk to the intro a bit, so it's a little bit easier. And I often find it just comes to me occasionally. If the final quote is just so good, I'll let the final quote trail off into infinity, you know, like a documentary ending without any sound over the credits. But generally, I like a sort of smart aleck end. The problem with that is, as we all know, most readers don't get to the end of your piece. So all that effort is usually wasted, I suspect.
Let's talk a little bit about how you got into writing. What are your first memories of writing? Were you very interested in it as a child?
Yeah, I'm not so much interested in writing as absolutely hopeless at doing anything else. I was really not very good at school until I could get to the sixth form and just write essays, at which point my academic career belatedly took off, and I got into Oxford to study English.
So you weren't a big creative writer, you were an essay writer?
Yes, and that's probably putting it a bit pompously. I think I was a journalist.
Really?
Yeah. When I was on the standard at that period when the big poster went up, I got a letter from a nursery school teacher, my nursery school, who said, Are you the same Andrew Billen who was a 5-year-old when asked what he wanted to do by me at Mrs. Potter's, said, I want to be a journalist. And I said, I wrote back and said, I think I must be.
Why do you think you wanted to be a journalist?
I loved the drama at that stage of news. I remember even being excited by the 1966 general election, just a little bit. I remember the programmes on TV on a Friday night in November in 1963 being interrupted with the news that President Kennedy had been shot, and I raced in to tell my mother. I must have been 5, and she said, no, go back and watch, take your pick. And then the phone went and it was my grandmother, and said, have you heard about President Kennedy? And that was my first scoop.
Yeah.
It was only delivered to the kitchen, but I got there before my grandmother. And I remember when Churchill died in, 65, I brought in the front page of the Daily Express, which was just one huge picture of Churchill. And then what really got me was the moon landing in 1969, when I, like I know, all kids of 11 were obsessed by it. But I was obsessed in a particularly nerdy way with the news coverage, particularly the TV coverage, the live coverage of the event. And for a while after that, I produced my own sort of lunar voyage coverage for family holiday trips, which I would deliver captions and commentary all the way to Northumberland or somewhere for my sister, who was bored rigid, and to the great irritation of my father, who was doing the driving. So I just really had a sort of cheap journalistic mind very early on.
Are you from a family of journalists? Or?
Not at all.
No.
No, my father was a salesman for sliced bread in bakeries around London. My mother was very literate, as an English teacher. We always read the papers. My grandmother got the Times and would read out to me and my younger brother the leader columns, and would say, like, and so it says here, she was Scottish, it says here that so Mr. Wilson will now have little choice but to go to the country. And she would say, go to the country means have an election. So I was quite well informed in those days.
Yeah.
Because it was the family interest. We had phone-ins on all the time. I loved the buzz of journalism, and I always knew, if not from five, from soon afterwards, that I wanted to be a journalist.
So when did you get your first professional job in journalism?
You see, it was so easy then. This was like 1980, and there were newspapers that were in profit around the nation that would train you to be a journalist. Mm. And I got my first job on the Sheffield Star, which is an evening paper in Sheffield, from an editor who hadn't been to university himself, but had worked on Harry Evans's Sunday Times, and was a complete snob about getting up kids from Oxbridge, southerners. So, you know, and I was brought up in Essex, actually in the epicentre of Towie, Brentwood, although it was nothing like that then. It was an anagram for bored town, it was very boring. But it was really very, very southern. And I went up to Sheffield and was going around doing what you call the death knocks on doors and knocking on all sorts of alien doors and going to pubs and stuff. And the Sheffield folk, who, like all Yorkshire people, pride themselves on being warm, would always say, you're not from around here, are you? What do you want? You know, occasionally they thought I was from the council and might give them a grant, but on the whole, they were pretty hostile. I was completely the wrong sort of person to have on that paper.
Wrong accent.
La-di-da, Oxford. And actually, I was quite miserable for about 3.5 years. Because it wasn't what the journalism that I was interested in was very like.
Do you think it was a good place for you, though, in terms of your sort of journalistic training? Or
I really...
You're miserable.
And I knew that at the time. I knew it was going to be miserable, but I would be able to say in 10 or 20 years' time, but I did it the hard way. And it's true, you do everything, or did everything in those days. You went to the courts, you went to the inquests, you went to the council meetings and the planning meetings and the fates, and you did knock on the doors of people whose children had been killed on a motorbike the night before, and you learned how to do everything. And you also made, I'm talking for myself, I made loads of mistakes as well, for which you're held accountable very quickly on a local paper. Mm. Because you don't burn your sources on a local paper because you need them all the time. So the mistakes were embarrassing, but they would have been more embarrassing if I'd been doing them on the Times.
Yeah. What was that? I mean, I have never done the death knock. What was that like?
It wasn't quite as bad as you'd think. Because a couple of things is, as sort of middle-class people, we assume we don't want our names in the paper unless we've written the story. For a lot of people, it's reassuring or validating or something to be in a newspaper. Mm. Otherwise, why would people talk to those real-life magazines in which the journalists will read back the copy, but never the headline. And then apparently very, very rarely does anybody mind what is written. And for the other reason is people who've had an awful bereavement quite often want to talk about it. And their neighbours and their friends are understandably very hesitant to come around.
It must have been a good training in how to have those kind of difficult, delicate conversations with people, which you still have to do in your interview work.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than no more difficult conversation to have.
So you then moved on to the Times, that's right, isn't it? That was your next...
Well, I came down in 1984 after 3.5 years on the Sheffield Star freelancing. That was the way. You couldn't actually enter Fleet Street directly because the unions wouldn't allow it. So you had to have provincial training or a magazine training. And you don't get a job immediately. So we did freelancing, and the only paper that would always try you out was the Daily Mail. And if I'd thought the newsroom in Sheffield had been quite tough, it hadn't prepared me at all for the vileness of the Daily Mail newsroom. And the news editor was Paul Dacre, who later became, of course, its infamous editor. And the atmosphere was absolutely appalling. And I was sent out on a death knock there, where the news desk simply wouldn't take, they won't speak to me for an answer. They kept asking me to go back. Oh, I remember knocking at the door, being, it was a man who'd shot his, a young man who'd shot his girlfriend by mistake. So I went back to the car, found a, of course, no mobile phones then, went back to, found a phone box, phoned the news desk, said, he won't talk to me. So just go back and I'll, you know, explain that you want to do a, you know, sympathetic piece. I did that, and this guy looked at me and said, "Are you stupid?" I said, "No." So I went back again to the phone box and said, "No, that he really won't talk to me." And the desk said, "Just go back one more time, actually."
God, that's awful.
And I wondered at that point if I was really being asked to make up a quote, if they're asking me to make something up. So I didn't go back the third time. And at that point, I thought, well, maybe I'm not cut out to be a Fleet Street journalist. Maybe I could run a news agent's, because I do like newspapers. I like to sort of, I know a lot about it. I'd be of interest to the customers. But then, thank God, a friend of a friend, Martha Carney, who's now on the Today programme but was then on OBC, said she had a friend called Angela who had just taken over the Times Diary gossip column, and she was looking for new writers, and would I like to be introduced? And I sort of said, oh, I don't think that's the way I want to get into. All right. And then, you know, we got on, and I got a job eventually, a staff job, and I felt like a huge... I felt as a, you know, huge success suddenly.
Yes.
And I was, because by my lights, I wasn't a Woodward or Bernstein, but I was being on a staff job. I could, on the good money compared with what I had been on, I could afford a small flat in Islington. Can you imagine on that?
Lovely.
And yeah, I've had an incredibly charmed life of going from staff job to staff job.
Yeah.
Ever since.
And you've done, so you did quite a long stint on the Times then, mm. And you are in the midst of another long stint on the Times
now.
Well,
this is a really long stint. The first stint was about 3 or 4 years, and this stint is 17 years and counting.
Okay, and I thought you might be interested to know that I looked up your name on the website and there were 2,604 results. I don't know if that's the precise number of articles you've written, but pretty good.
Well, it's horrifying, isn't it? That really... You sometimes think, when I'm 61 now, and I think, would I like to do it all again? Would I like to be younger? And I thought, well, yeah, I'd like to be younger, but, you know, I don't want to write 1,000. I didn't know it was 2,600. I don't want to write at that desk another 2,600 interviews up. No, thanks.
You also did stints at, well, the Evening Standard, as we've discussed briefly, and The Observer.
Which is where I really started writing features.
Yeah.
And interviews.
Yeah. I remember vividly the first interview that I ever did, which, I mean, I think I made a complete pig's ear of, but I remember coming away from it feeling completely elated and like, this is just what I want to do every day from now on. Do you remember the first interview you did?
I even started doing this on the Sheffield Star. I worked in the Rotherham office, which was just like a slip edition, and I started doing regular interview with personalities on that. So I can't remember the first one, but I remember the pleasure of having a bit more space to write a bit more cleverly about people. And then when I started doing the celebrity interviews, can't remember who the actress was, but I remember walking out of the Dorchester thinking, God, I don't think she said that to anybody before. And that's a really good line. And feeling absolutely,
such a,
you know,
high.
But it was such a high on it, yeah. Then I discovered she said it on Parkinson the next night or something.
Oh, but, I hate it when they do that.
Yeah, but there's nothing, as you know, I'm sure you feel the same way. If it goes well and you get something that's almost like a news story out of an interview, there's no greater feeling.
Yeah. Well, I remember being at the Times when you did your interview with Henry Bolton, who was the sacked, I think, leader of UKIP, who left
his
wife.
He was sacked, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yes, he left his wife for this other woman who it then turned out had been tweeting vile racist things about Meghan Markle. And I remember actually being at our editor Nicola Gill's desk when your copy came in and how excited she was that you had a news line.
Yeah. It doesn't happen that often. But I do feel on that sort of thing, obviously the UKIP PR and Henry wanted to talk about fishing rights, you know, that were in jeopardy, and that actually got me to talk to some local fishermen in wherever it was, Deal or somewhere. But you do, I do feel you're there. You've got to ask about the embarrassing story. And I just said, you know, what I really don't understand, Henry, is how you could be in love with a racist. You know?
Yeah.
The PR was going shaking. But Henry was happy enough to talk about that.
Will you tell me a little bit about your, would you sort of talk me through your approach to an interview step by step, what you do beforehand and what you're trying to do when you're in the room with them?
Well, I think that for an interview, I was just thinking about this morning in relation to our chat, is there, there's like three things you have to do. You have to think of good questions, which you're clearly very good at. Then you have to sort of put people in a frame of mind where they want to talk, which you're also good at. And then if you're a writing journalist, then you've got to find a way to write it entertainingly. And I'd say the last bit is the bit you have a bit more discretion over, and you can develop your own style. But I don't see any much, I don't see, as a print journalist at least, any way around really doing a lot of homework before an interview. So I'm interviewing Frank Skinner tomorrow, the comedian, and I am trying to read both his autobiographies, even though it's only for a 1400 word piece. That's partly to give yourself confidence.
Yeah.
But reading all the cuttings, as we used to call them, which is so easy to do now.
All the interviews he's done before.
Yeah, which means you know the interesting areas, but you also know the areas that he said the same thing again and again and again, so you know areas to avoid. Sometimes they're flattered if you know a lot about them when you go in. Often they assume that you do and have read all their novels, so you don't want to piss them off by not having done so. So there are loads of reasons to do proper research as much as you can. And the idea that you can go in and wing it, you know, have not watched the movie you're going to talk about or something, I think is horrendous. I interviewed Larry King once, who did interviews incredibly successfully for CNN for decades, and he never did any research.
Really?
And I said, what do you do instead? And he said, I just ask why. And he said, and it's a really good point, actually. Why is by far the best question. If you ask the question, you know, what was your favourite role? And he says, Hamlet. That's the end, unless you say why, and then you get the reasoning. And then when you're in the room, the thing about being in the room is you never know what it's going to be like. You never know what the atmosphere is going to be like, whether they're going to be hostile, chatty, suspicious, shy, over-talkative.
And you often know, you know, sometimes the people who are going to be difficult have a reputation for that. So sometimes you're going in probably with a bit of anxiety about how it's going to go.
Yeah, people sometimes say, do you get nervous before an interview? And I'd say, I sort of never get nervous about meeting people now. I'm always actually energised by meeting new people. But I am nervous about not getting anything good out of them. And there's frequently the sort of feeling 20 minutes in, it's all very well, but I haven't got anything.
Yeah.
That horrible feeling.
Horrible inner panic.
Yeah.
I'm going to have
to get him or her off this. And I'm going to have to interject something a bit harder question. Because I don't believe this Lynn Barber thing, you're going asking the worst question first, because I think that's just going to piss them off and get barriers up. And how you make people talk, I think is a bit up to you as well. But generally, I try to be a little bit conspiratorial, like we both know this is a bit of artifice, and don't say that, but it's slightly sort of knowing, trying to be reasonably, you know, humorous, ironic. I mean, sometimes people don't get it at all, and then you go a bit more straight, and ask and be pleasant. I've tried the other thing of doing a Paxman. There's absolutely no point in it. It will get you about 5 or 6 paragraphs of sparky dialogue, but it doesn't get you the revelations and the intimacy that you really need to go for. And I've found generally, as you get older and you care less about how you put what people think about you, maybe you can ask the hard questions, but ask them in a soft voice, and often you'll be quite surprised. Like Sean Bean was always meant to be very, very prickly on, because he's had five wives or something. I saw him earlier this year, and one, the last wife just came up to me before we went in, was really incredibly chatty, and you know, I dare say there'd been some discussion on how to approach me, but he was really comparatively open. And you, but if you don't ask, if you don't try asking about the delicate points in somebody's life, they're not going to volunteer it.
Also, what actually one of the most useful things that Nicola Jill, who is also your editor,
she's always been my editor, it seems.
But one of the most useful things she said to me was, you have to ask the question, and even if they don't answer, it doesn't matter, because you've asked it and then you've got some kind of response and you can work with that.
That's very good advice.
Yeah, which I thought was useful because it's sometimes there are questions that you just know are unpleasant and are going to get their backs up, and you can sympathise with why they don't want to answer it.
But again, you can say why. You should say, I really don't want to talk about that. And say, why? Why? Is it still very painful? You
know? Yeah.
So you've got something there, haven't you?
Yeah.
And it does, I know to a civilian, I suppose it sounds incredibly intrusive, even asking the question. But I don't think it's just journalists who read other journalists' copy in magazines. I think ordinary people, readers, paying readers, look at something and think, well, that's a bit, you know, they didn't ask anything about Jennifer Aniston. No.
Yes.
And I just feel diddled.
Yeah.
You're not there to make friends. You know, some journalists go in and they end up friends for life, you know, with Nicole Kidman. And I'm really not interested in it, in that.
Yeah. Do you double record? Do you take
Yeah, I do.
Do you?
On my phone.
I need to start doing
I have a spare recording. It's not as bad as the cassette days, and frequently nothing happened.
God, that's awful.
And only once have I found it completely impossible to get something back. I think that's with Gerald Kaufman, but tapes have been awful in the past. So for a long time, I think Cosmo Landsman told me he always had two tape recorders, and I started after that.
And do you take notes? Do you have anything in front of you, or do you try and go
I'm like you, I might have I was doing one yesterday, I have a clipboard with not so much questions as subject areas, and also just a few names like husband,
yes,
film, so that you don't suddenly have a mental block on a vital name. I know Michael Parkinson, the legendary TV interviewer, said he once interviewed John Wayne and he just forgot his name during the interview, which was fine until the end, when you got to say thank you John Wayne. So he said, what am I going to do? He said, all he could think was that his nickname was Duke, and he said, may I call you Duke? Thank you, Duke.
That
he always put the name of his interview on the top of his clipboard, and I think nothing else. And yeah, I always put the name of the person I'm interviewing as well.
You recently got the exclusive with David Cameron when his memoir came out.
Well, that sounds like I sort of stood outside his door for 4 months until he'd see me. The Times,
well, I don't know your methods.
The Times had bought the book, and an interview came with that. It's very often, and I was asked to do it. It was fantastic.
A big deal. Yeah. You had to do it under very sort of testing conditions. Tell me a bit about that.
The hard bit of that was the research side of it, because the book hadn't been published. So it was under wraps, because the whole impact of that book was that you didn't know what was going to be in it exactly, mainly about Brexit. So I had to read it over 10 hours in a closed office at his publishers, without a camera, or a phone with a camera, or a notebook.
So you couldn't make any notes?
No.
I mean, it's just awful. Were you in there solidly for 10 hours? Did they bring you snacks?
Yeah, they brought me a cup of coffee. And actually, I did go out for lunch. And then when I went out for lunch to the nearby Pret, I wrote down everything I could remember. And then when I got the train back from London to Oxford, I spent the whole hour just jotting down juicy bits in my head. It's a bit of a memory test, but it was interesting. So it wasn't as hard as people might think it was, and it wasn't a book of philosophical thought or anything.
But you scored because you remembered that he had referred to Michael Gove as mendacious, and he actually couldn't remember having said that.
That's right. You know, it's like, is it Katie Price who could never remember what's in a book? Because not only has she not written them, she hasn't read them either. I don't know if that's the case with David Cameron. God, nearly forgot his name. I think it's, I think the book probably was helped into print by some, not ghostwriters, but by people who looked over it, and maybe he didn't actually quite remember exactly the adjective he'd used. But yeah, and then he said, I don't think I use that word. And so later I phoned up the publisher and said, did he? And she said, yeah.
Yeah. I think you're very good at humanising people who are not necessarily hugely sympathetic on first glance. And there are some interviewers who will go in very tough. And that Henry Bolton one stood out to me because I felt that you somehow were sympathetic to him while also not letting him off the hook.
There are really entertaining features written and profiles written which are complete takedowns of people. And, you know, Lynn Barber was brilliant at it. And I was influenced by these people when I started. But as I've got on doing it for 30 years, I've got less and less interested in just doing that complete demolition job on someone. For one thing, you're judging people on an hour in a room with them. They might just be having a bad day. It's difficult not to take it out on them if they're being really uncooperative, because why should they do the interview? But even that's not enough to damn a person completely. But I like to add value to an interview by finding out new things, rather than reinforcing what everybody thinks already. And that, of course, leads to the other really boring thing, which is, before I met X, I always thought they were an arrogant so-and-so. But when I met him, he was really charming. Well, of course he was, because
you're interviewing him.
Yeah. So I don't know which is worse. What I'm really saying is that I really hate news. I hate news stories, because I always think they start off with such a simplification in the headline that it might as well be a lie. And the first paragraph is probably has only a tenuous relationship to the truth. But if you read right through to the end and get to the rebuttal and everything, you might by the end have got a reasonable idea where the truth lies. But for me, the point of doing a feature, not just interviews, but any feature, is to introduce nuance and the other side of the argument and the other point of view, and to be pretentious. You know, it's trying to extend people's imaginative sympathy a bit into areas and corners that they don't know.
Have you ever done an interview that's gone spectacularly badly?
Yes.
Who was it?
I did an actress who, on the Observer days, I can't even remember, Amanda, I can't remember her name now, but she just said, I don't suppose I was doing a particularly great interview with her, but she just said halfway through the lunch at the Groucho Club, this is boring, you're boring me. And I said, well, I'm very, very sorry to hear that. What are you going to do after this? And she said, I'm going to see my accountant. And I said, well, that really does sound boring. And she said, no, that's, I'm always interested to know how much I'm earning. How much do you earn? And I said, 42,000. And she said, a year? How do you manage on that? This was about 1992 or something. And fine, thanks, Amanda. I've got my interview now. And of course, the Observer readers were absolutely outraged that she should think 42,000 wasn't a lot of money, which it was. Then.
Did you have that thing of the PR kind of calling you immediately afterwards to try and make some sort of excuse for her? Or? No,
in those days, the PRs were less frequently in the room, so I didn't have that. You must have had PRs ringing and saying, I don't think she didn't mean that. And,
often, yeah.
And if you could leave that out, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and it's quite difficult. I mean, what do you say in response to... Because sometimes people are very charming, but you must think, well, I'm not going to take that out. Or are you just very honest with people?
Yeah, well, so she, you know, they did say that when the tape recorder was going and stuff. It's just a reasonable... You know, it's just like his wife will be really upset about that. Or... but then if I find, or could you not mention the previous, the boyfriend that was mentioned, and then I find it's been mentioned in Grazia or something, you know,
yeah,
a year ago. So that I'm saying I can't do anything about something that's already in the public realm. And there are other times when I check whether somebody said something that they really want in the paper. I interviewed Chris Evans years ago, and he said his wife had just had a ectopic pregnancy and had a fallopian tube removed. And she would probably only have one child. Well, thankfully, he's had loads since then. And I was just looking at this on the transcript and said, is she really going to want to see this gynecological stuff in the Times? So I texted him and said, you mentioned this, is, are you sure it's all right to for me to include it? And he texted back and said, it is all right, because I've checked three times with my wife.
Oh.
But thank you very much for asking.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't... It's only newspapers.
Yeah.
No, it's not something that's going to... It's not a court of law where you have to tell the whole truth and nothing but... But the truth. I mean, tell nothing but the truth, but you don't have to say absolutely everything that's going to ruin somebody's life. And there has been stuff I've done that I regret including.
Really? Yeah. I suppose you don't want to tell me what it is now, because that would be like repeating it again.
It would be, in a way. There was something an actor told me about his personal life that he had told me previously when I met him. Over dinner, and then I knew this was a sort of quite a sensational story ish and so I saw him again, and I said, I don't really want to talk about that. And I said, oh, you know, go on. So it's very naively, really, on his part. He told it all again to me, two tape recorders running in a restaurant in Manhattan. And then the day before it was published, I emailed him, said, this is going to appear tomorrow. It was about something he hadn't told his wife, or his ex-partner. And then it came out, and it was on the Standard, and his PR, his agent, was absolutely furious, said, I'd never interview another one of his clients again. It was all off the record. Well, I don't think it was off the record, because he spoke for about 20 minutes about it.
Yeah.
Having said he didn't want to, so that wasn't off the record. But in the end, I thought, no, this was... I didn't need to... I shouldn't have done it.
Mm.
I felt... And the worst thing I have is guilt. I mean, I've done... Made a mistake. Factual error is bad. But actually something a bit bad faith I really can't live with these days. Mm. Or any... Certainly not in the last couple of decades. I've hated it.
Are there any questions that you regret not asking? You have a
thought,
I was too
sure.
soft on that person, or I should have pushed a bit more.
I mean, the Times years ago flew me off to see Annie Leibovitz, and it was a good, I think it was a good interview, because some funny stuff happened. You know, she's this great New York fashion photographer, and she was living with, her girlfriend was Susan Sontag, but it was always described as her friend, and, you know, they're always put together, but nobody actually said that they were lovers. And so we talked about her, and Susan Sontag had been ill, and I was asking about her. How she, oh, she said, you know, she's as strong as her arc, she'll outlive us all, and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, describe your relationship. Oh, we're just so sympathetic to each other, and blah, 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 blah. And when I got back, Sandra, my then editor, said, and did you ask whether they were actually lovers? No, I didn't.
Mm, not explicitly.
I just didn't ask, no, explicitly. And then a few years later, a brave journalist on the New York Times did say, you've never said this on the record, but are you and well, were you and Susan Sontag lovers? And Andy was it so? Yeah, I really love that word. Yes, that's what we were. I thought, God, why was I so squeamish? Maybe it wasn't just so acceptable to be gay, you know, even 15 years ago. But that was real cowardice by me. I mean, she's a formidable lady, but...
Yeah. You've been in journalism for 40 years, is that
well,
right?
Well, yes. Ish. So I sort of, ish, certainly. So I think I joined my training scheme on the Sheffield Star in 1980, in the autumn. So, yeah, it'd be 40 years next year.
Yeah. Have you witnessed lots of changes in journalism?
So there's less money around, there are more PRs around, there's the access to celebrities is less, the fewer interviews are done in people's studies, bedrooms, more in hotel rooms. American PRs are much more aggressive, give you less time, more prescriptive of what you can say. The requests for copy approval, which we never accede to, but they're much more than there were. You know, I used to work with Jane Bowen, who was a great, really great portrait newspaper photographer of our age. And she'd been around for yonks from the 50s in the Observer. And she and a feature writer would just turn up to the Savoy in London at the hotel and go to the public relations man and said, "Who have you got in?" And they said, we've got Fred Astaire, you know.
Wow.
we've got Grace Kelly. Do you want us to arrange some time? And they'll go. And the interview was really bland, but the portraits were fantastic.
Yeah.
But now, as you know, working on the Times, people on the magazine, like Simon Hills, spend months trying to figure out if they can get an interview for me or anybody else. But with people who are not even superstars.
Yeah. Do you find that it's better to interview people who aren't mega famous?
I find the very best thing is people who are on either on the way up, but the trouble is people aren't that interested. But people on the way down or just got old, they're much more frank, have less to lose.
Yeah.
It's the people at the height of their first fame are tricky.
When you look back over your work over the last 40 years, you know, I'm sure that it has improved and you've honed it over that time. Can you see sort of breakthrough moments where you learnt something that really changed the way you approached your job?
I can't offhand remember. It's a cumulative thing, learning a bit more sensitivity, being a bit less brash, but also being braver in asking questions. I think that's come to me over the years. And maybe writing in a slightly less ornate style.
Really, you've pared back your
writing style. A little bit, yes. I remember a friend saying his mother never understood a word I wrote in the Observer. You're probably right. It's not why say iconography? in a piece, the iconography of stardom or something. You know,
yeah.
Why don't you just say this? You know, the signs and trappings or something.
Yeah.
Instead. So, yeah, I'm a bit less of a intellectual snob, maybe. It's weird now. I don't think many people do the same job for 30 years. And certainly a lot
40
of my...
years.
Well, 40 years, if you count the first 10 years of diary stories and commissioning and death knocks, yeah. So I'd say the job generally, the interviewing job has been the same for 30 years. And nobody does that now, or very few people. And you expect people now to do broadcasting instead or become an editor, become a digital editor.
A copywriter.
Start a magazine. PR. Something, you know. It's just as if these people are just always desperate to get out of doing the most enjoyable job. I don't get it.
What are you proudest of when you look back over your career?
So just sustaining it, still being paid to write pieces. I think it's incredible. I'd love to say there's one piece that I'm really proud of the Cameron thing because it was got a lot of attention and that was fun and being interviewed in the garden by the BBC Breakfast and stuff. That was so I'm kind of proud of that and proud that it wasn't a massive mistake in it or. You know, people, not everybody said I'd been too soft or whatever. But what I am going to do, because my kids are still young enough not to really understand what I'm doing, when I do stop, I would like to go through all my cuttings, and which I keep mainly just as cuttings, and maybe pick out 40 pieces, not just interviews, but like 3 days I spent on lighthouses and just publish them as I don't think anybody want to publish it, but as a vanity project, to put it together into a little book, so that when I'm, you know, when I'm gone, they can look back and say, oh, that was what he was doing, he had fun doing that, and he met some really interesting people. And I, you know, to be frank, I might well, in my complete dotage, look back on it and wistfully enjoy reading those better pieces again.
Well, I'd buy it.
Oh, it's very kind. You can have one free.
Brilliant Andrew Billin there. He said he hadn't been interviewed much before, but he quite enjoyed the experience. Thanks for listening. Do let me know what you think on Twitter, where I'm @HattieHattie, or you can use the hashtag InWriting. See you next time.